going to be our last class. We're talking about Al-Ghazali. I'm really happy that I got a chance to get as far as looking at his Jerusalem letter, because I had read about it, I don't know, years ago, I guess, and I'd read a bunch of things by Al-Ghazali, but never read the Jerusalem letter. And I think it kind of lives up to its hype. I mean, it's nice and short. It's only about, 25 pages or so, and it's all pretty dense, which is nice. You have a lot of ideas per unit page. And anyway, it is a very nice summary of his general viewpoint, which is, of course, a really good illustration of the Asherite theology. And all I've been doing ever since we finished looking at the Quran itself is we are looking at its early interpretations. And just like in Christianity, the early interpretations range from a willingness to interpret things allegorically or figuratively or metaphorically, whatever, versus a tendency to interpret them more literally. And you have that same tension probably in every religion, I guess. And, of course, neither camp is a pure example of what I'm talking about. I mean, the allegorists will certainly interpret certain things literally, and the literalists will certainly interpret some things allegorically. It really is a matter of degree. Well, anyway, we went over in the first part of the Jerusalem letter, we went over his arguments for the existence of God and for the what was the second thing we went over? It was I have a hard time remembering. Oh, it was. That God is not a material being. That's right. And then the unity of God. And then God, the eternity of God's speech, which of course is related to the idea of the Quran being, eternal. And then we got into the topic that we all love to hate. And let me just read you the third pillar, because remember, he has four pillars altogether, and under each pillar he's got 10 fundamentals, so that gives you 40 fundamentals altogether. But let me just read you once again, I read this last time or 2 weeks ago, his summary of the third pillar, because this is the one that we talk about over and over again, and I think Al-Ghazali is more extreme, or maybe I should say the Asherite school is more extreme than anything in Christianity, even Calvin, let alone Augustine. Calvin is more extreme than Augustine. I'll just read you the summary, and then we'll look at the details. We had started on that last time. The third is concerned with his works. That's the third pillar. And includes 10 fundamentals. That God Most High is creator of his servants' actions. That these actions are acquired by his servants, that they are willed by him, that he is gracious to create and to create from nothing, that it is his prerogative to impose duties beyond the capacity of his servants and to cause pain to the innocent, that it is not incumbent upon him to do the most favorable thing to his servants, and that man's obligations are all laid down in the divine law, that his sending of the prophets is not impossible, and that the prophethood of our prophet Muhammad is proved and confirmed by miracles. Okay. The last little bit is not really related to the idea of God's absolute control of the universe, but almost everything else under the third pillar is just that. Let me reread his statement of the first fundamental, which I got this far last time, but I'll reread it. His statement of the first fundamental under the first pillar, and that is this: the first fundamental, the knowledge that everything originated in the universe is his work, creation, and invention. None other than him is the creator and originator. He created men and created their actions and initiated their capacity and their movement. Thus, all the actions of his servants are created by him and dependent upon his power, as is confirmed by his word, blah, blah, blah. Remember the Asherite metaphysical position. We call it occasionalism, the idea that at every instant of time, God is recreating every minimal part of space. And so that means everything in the universe is getting recreated at every instant of time, and those instants are really, really fast. And which of course implies that everything that happens is a result of God's recreation. And I drew an analogy to a puppet show where, you know, Judy is hitting Punch over the head with a broom and Punch is rubbing his head. And you say, well, you might be inclined to say, or a child might say, oh, gee, you know, Judy is causing Punch to rub his head. But as a matter of fact, Judy's hitting him over the head with the broom is only the occasion of Punch's rubbing his head, because the real cause is the puppeteer. And so God is the master puppeteer, as it were. God is controlling everything in the universe. I mean, really everything in the universe. And of course, it follows from that, then, that all human actions are under God's control as well. Right? I mean, if God is controlling everything, then, of course, God is controlling human actions, too. And so that's the initial statement of God's omnipotence. But then, of course, a lot of stuff follows from that, and a lot of stuff that we are uncomfortable with. And this is what, you know, we have argued this and argued this and argued this. It's the doctrine that we love to hate. And obviously, predestination follows from this. I mean, predestination is simply, is a much, if Augustine is a predestinationist. You know, Augustine is a single predestinationist, and Calvin is what we call a double predestinationist. Well, what I mean by that is Augustine says, well, God predestines the elect to do whatever, to love God, whatever's necessary in order to be saved. And then God just kind of stands back and lets the reprobate follow their own accord, whereas Calvin says, well, God predestined, God intervenes with both the elect and the reprobate, so that's double predestination. Well, it's an even stronger claim here in Al-Ghazali. I'm jumping to the third fundamental. The third fundamental is that, though acquired, the actions of God's servants are still willed by God Most High. Of course, everything that God does, God wills, right? For nothing happens in the seen and unseen universe, not even the twinkling of an eye or an unguarded thought, except by God's predetermined purpose, His power, and His will. He is the cause of good and evil. Bonnie asked me last week, is God, you know, also the cause of evil? Yes, yes, because God's the cause of everything. So, of course, God's the cause of evil. Benefit and harm, Islam and infidelity, acknowledgement and denial of God, success and failure, rectitude and error, obedience and rebellion, association of other gods with Him, and belief in Him alone. There is nothing that can defeat His predetermined purpose, and none to question His dominion. Okay? So, yeah, I mean, if you don't believe in God, if you're a polytheist, like, you know, in the time of Muhammad, you're a polytheist, well, that's God operating on your belief that is responsible for that. Why? Well, you got a problem with that? I mean, that's kind of the response we have here. So let's go on. It is still,
Don, can I interject here?
Oh, sure, yeah.
That doesn't mean to me that your life is predestined at birth, because it just means God is doing what God wants at that instant, and that doesn't mean that, using the term loosely, that God can't change His mind.
Well, but God is sort of outside time anyway, and, you know, all of this is eternal from God's perspective. So it's not a matter of, you know, coming up with an idea and then changing, you know, your mind and stuff like that. So it is indeed an all at once sort of thing from God's perspective. So it is really predestination kind of from our perspective, I guess you'd say. It is still further confirmed by human reason. If disobedience to God and crime abhorrent to God and not willed by him, but rather willed by the devil, God curse him, it would mean that what takes place in accordance with the will of this enemy is greater than what takes place in accordance with his will most high. In other words, if the devil were responsible for some of the evil in the world, then God wouldn't be responsible for it, and that would be inconsistent with God's absolute sovereignty. I cannot imagine a Muslim permitting himself to reduce the status of the mighty God from his position of majesty and honor to a level which, were a village chief reduced to it, he would disdain to accept it. So,
then what is the role of the devil in their view?
Well, it would be God's agent then. I mean, you know, the devil really does exist, obviously, for Al-Ghazali. But the devil is not independent of God's power, put it that way. I mean, God can work through the devil, just as God can work through a human being to do whatever God wants to happen.
But he said God cursed him.
Is the devil God?
That's only a formula, right? I mean, every time you mention Muhammad, of course, it's, you know, may God, I forget exactly what the formula is, but
peace be upon him.
Yeah, that kind of thing. Or any of the prophets, actually. And, of course, God, too. The devil then has the opposite little formula here. Was somebody going to say something else? I thought I saw.
Well, it wouldn't make sense for the devil to be thought of as wicked if he's only doing what God said to do. Isn't that sort of what you're saying, Bonnie?
Sorry, I muted. Yes, it's inconsistent.
Yeah.
To describe.
Oh,
him that
we're
way,
gonna we're gonna we're
he's
gonna
really God's agent.
Yeah, we're gonna answer that question in just a second. Actually, you're gonna squirm when I give you the answer. Before I do, yes.
God is Tony Soprano and the devil is one of his goons.
Well, kind of. Yeah. Okay, here's the answer to the question. This is really one of the great things about Al-Ghazali is he's really a very clear writer. I have to hand it to him. So, if it is asked, why? Why does he forbid what he wills and orders what he does not will? We would reply that order is different from will. Hence the following example. This is an okay example. I'll give it a C, maybe. A master strikes his slave and is rebuked by the Sultan. He offers as an excuse the rebellious conduct of the slave, but the Sultan refuses to believe him. Desirous of proving himself right, he gives an order which he knows the slave would disobey in the presence of the Sultan. Saddle that beast, he said, thus ordering what he really does not want the slave to obey. So this is just an analogy. But without giving the order, his excuse would not have been apparent to the Sultan. On the other hand, if he really wanted obedience, he would have wanted his own destruction, which is impossible. Okay, well, but the point is, you got to make a distinction between God, what God commands and what God wills. Obviously, everything that God wills, God does. I mean, and remember, God is recreating the universe at every instant of time. So clearly, God is recreating the universe in accordance with whatever God wills. So whatever God wills, God does. And whatever God does, God wills. It's an if and only if kind of thing, right? But it turns out that God commands things too. And, of course, it also turns out that some people disobey God's commands. Well, they can only disobey God's commands if God wills them to disobey God's commands, which then implies that God's commands and God's will don't track necessarily with one another. In other words, God gives you commands, and some of those commands may be things that God wills you not to do. But, you know, so then you start recoiling at that thought, and the reply is, you got a problem with that? Who do you think you are, you puny little human being, to complain about what God decides to do? Can't God decide to do whatever God decides to do? I mean, God is not another human being. God is not the President of the United States or something whom we can criticize. God is something completely different from anything that we can ever conceptualize. So who do you think you are saying why? Oh, come on. Right? That's the idea. So remember that. What God commands and what God wills are two separate things. And God can command what God does not will. And God can, well, either one. God can, you know, will, God can command you to do X and will you to do not X. Or God can command you not to do X and will you to do X, right? The point is they don't have to align with one another.
But you can't not do what, I mean,
yes,
you're stuck doing what God really wants you to do, even if he commanded you
exactly,
not to do.
Exactly.
So there's no free will at all.
Exactly. That is right.
That's really twisted.
I somehow knew you would like it.
Tom.
That prayer is useless?
Well, it depends on, well, once again, here we go again. I mean, you're talking about two levels of discourse. So if from the sort of macroscopic level, we see things as, you know, we pray to God and so forth and so on. And, you know, if God wills it, then yes, the prayer leads to something, you know, good or something like that.
Okay.
Same old, same old.
All right.
Yeah.
So God willed me to pray, so I prayed.
And then God rewarded you for praying or something, or God granted your prayer or something along those lines, right? Okay.
In this situation, why would God bother to create the universe at all?
To begin a sentence with the words "Why does God?" or "Why would God?" is illicit.
Okay.
Right, because the buck stops at God's will. I mean, God, don't think of God. I think Al-Ghazali would say, updating kind of what he would maybe say.
Uh-huh.
You know, you're looking at God anthropomorphically. If you say, why would God, you know, or why does God, or any of those kind of questions. Because, of course, you can ask that of another person, you know. Always. You know, why in the world did Biden do X or something like that? Reasonable
okay.
question. But God isn't a person. Yeah.
So in Al-Ghazali's view, the question why is never valid.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
The buck stops at God's will. There is no why. And of course, there are several consequences of that, right? One of them, the fifth fundamental, is that contrary to the Metazoites, remember the Metazoites, one of the nicknames, remember the five fundamentals in Al-Jabbar, but the first two fundamentals were more equal than others. one of the nicknames, as far as I know, of the Metazoites was the people of unity and justice. Meaning by that, God's unity and God's justice. Those are the two major doctrines that they were insisted upon. Well, you know, God is not just. And that's okay, because who are we to complain about, you know, God? Same old, same old. But anyway, the fifth fundamental is that contrary to the Metazoites, God, glory be to him, may impose obligations on the servants which are beyond their ability. For were it not so, it would be impossible for them to pray to him, saying, our Lord, do thou not burden us beyond what we have strength to bear. That's a quote from the Quran. So that prayer would be impossible if it were not possible for God to impose obligations upon a person that person cannot possibly fulfill. And then also, he imagines this kind of contradictory consequence also from the Talos of Light. Now, also because God Most High informed his prophet, God bless him and save him, that Abu Jahl would not believe him. And then he commanded the prophet to call Abu Jahl to believe God's words, which included the prediction that he wouldn't believe. How then could he believe him by not believing? Is this proposition anything but impossible to conceive? Right? So, I mean, that was another instance where God predicts that Abu Jahl will not believe and then requires the prophet, Muhammad, to tell Abu Jahl to believe that set of propositions, which include the prediction that he won't believe. Well, of course, that's something that's impossible to do. So God is requiring then something that's impossible. You got a problem with that? The sixth fundamental is, again, that it is, again, contrary to the Metazoites. God, to whom glory and majesty belong, may inflict pain on his creatures or torment them for no previous offense or subsequent reward. For he has absolute control over his creatures and his dominion, and any dominion outside it is inconceivable for his control to embrace it. Thus, injustice, which is the disposal of what belongs to others without permission, is impossible in God Most High, for he encounters no possessions of others besides him, so that his disposal of these possessions could be injustice. This is the first of three arguments, by the way. So God, this fundamental is that God, you know, this goes back to Bonnie's question of last week. Now it's been a while since I've read Job, the book of Job, but it does seem to me that Job kind of comes, the book that is, kind of comes down on this same side of things. If God wants to inflict suffering, once again, who are you, little puny human being, to ask the question why? To question that. Can't God do whatever God wants to do? You know, and in chapter 9 of Romans, right? Can't the potter make a pot to do, for ordinary use as opposed to exalted use or something like that? Potter can do whatever the potter jolly well wants to do. So can God. Here, first of all, Al-Ghazali is saying, as Gilbert Ryle would say, it's a category mistake to attribute justice or injustice to God. It's like asking if heat can be beautiful or ugly. It doesn't make any sense. Beautiful and ugly don't even have an application in that domain. Well, similarly, the words justice and injustice just don't apply to God because, he says, well, justice and injustice usually has something to do with property. And, you know, that's good. That doesn't have anything to do with God. God doesn't own anything. So we can't really talk about justice and injustice with respect to God. So that's the first argument. Remember, the Metazoites, the people of unity and justice, they were insistent that God is absolutely just. And here Al-Ghazali is saying, no, to use the words just or unjust of God is simply committing a category mistake. God is not the kind of being to whom those words even meaningfully apply. Second argument. Now, the proof that causing pain for no offense or reward is permissible is its presence in practice. Thus, the slaughter of animals. Now, this is maybe a little far-fetched, but anyway, I'll read it. This is the second argument anyway. Thus, the slaughter of animals and the various kinds of torture they suffer at the hands of man is for no previous offense that they've committed. If it is said that God will reward such animals in the next world for what they had suffered and that this was incumbent upon him, we would reply as follows. He would go beyond the bounds of religious law and reason. Who would maintain that it's incumbent upon God to bring back to life every ant killed under the feet and every being crushed between the fingers in order to reward it for its suffering? For he would thereby consider bringing to life and rewarding his obligations on him. God's not going to, if you're insisting that God somehow has to make amends for unmerited suffering, what about animals? Don't they suffer? And did they deserve the suffering that they had to undergo? No. Well, then it would be incumbent upon God to make amends for their suffering too. But that's ridiculous, as long as Ali. The third argument is actually the third argument is his version of a rather famous argument. And the way it's treated in the tradition is three brothers. Now, he doesn't have it as three brothers. He has it as two unrelated people and then a whole bunch of other people. So I'll read what he has to say, but it's but I'll just kind of set up the traditional way of that it's usually related. The three brothers, brother one goes to heaven, and brother two goes to hell. Brother three goes to heaven, but is in an inferior state in heaven because brother three was only a child when brother three died. So that one doesn't get the full treatment, you know, the gardens and all the beautiful women and the fruits and so forth and so on. Brother three goes to heaven, but it doesn't have all the full, you know, all the full delights that an adult would have. Okay. Well, anyway, that's how it's framed I guess it's the traditional way of recounting the story, but Al-Ghazali has it a little differently. So I'll read you what he has. Concerning the Mu'tazilite contention that it is incumbent upon God to do the favorable for his servants, I wonder what his reply would be if the following question were posed to him. Let him assume a comparison in the next world between two who died Muslims, a minor boy and an immature adult. According to the Mu'tazilite doctrine, it is incumbent upon God to elevate and prefer the adult over the boy on account of his toil in belief and worship after maturity. So in other words, God is completely just, and the boy, you know, had an immature belief. He didn't do all the things that the adult did. The adult went on the pilgrimage, gave alms to the poor, did all the things that you're supposed to do as a good Muslim, had accumulated incredible amounts of virtue. Well, if God's completely just, then that person gets rewarded up, the person's up here, and the boy is, you know, somewhere down here. Didn't have a chance to do all that, but anyway, didn't do it still. But anyway, suppose the boy prayed, "O Lord, why hast thou elevated him over me?" And God would say, "Because after maturity he was diligent in worship." You know, he deserved more, he did more. Then the boy would say, "Lord, thou hast caused me to die a child. It was incumbent upon me to prolong my life till maturity so I could be just as diligent. Thou hast deviated from justice by favoring him with long life, but not me. Why," there's that word again, "why hast thou so favored him?" And God would say, this is according to the Mu'tazilites, by the way, keep in mind, this is what the Mu'tazilites would say. And God would say, "Because I knew you would take associates with me," and this, in other words, like become a Christian, have other parts of the Trinity and so forth, "and disobey me, had you attained maturity, it was best for you to die a child. Such would be the Mu'tazilite excuse on behalf of God, to whom glory and majesty belong." Now, I know you know what's coming up. That's in the traditional account, that's brothers one and three. Well, how about brother number two, who was consigned to hell? Right? You know what's coming up. So here, hearing this, the infidels from the abyss of hell would call, "O Lord, hast thou not known that we would have taken associates with thee on attaining maturity? Why hast thou not caused us to die in childhood? We could have been content in paradise with an even lower status than that of the Muslim boy." With what could this question be answered? None, except a definite decision that divine questions are too sublime and majestic to be decided by the logic of the Mu'tazilites. Okay. So, you know, there you go. I mean, the boy did not receive as, well, like brother number three, if, to put it back in the, you know, traditional way of looking, of reciting it, recounting it. Brother number three didn't have the chance to, you know, do all the things that would give him a higher status in heaven. And then when brother number three complains to God, God says, "Well, the reason I had you die as a child is because you would have deviated. We would have wound up in hell otherwise." And then, of course, brother number two says, well, then why didn't you kill me off as a child? You know, Mu'tazilites have no answer to that to that question.
Don, yeah. How does Al-Ghazali get around all those things that we read in the Quran where it says, you know, when giving commands, these are the things that a Muslim is supposed to do, and God sees everything you do, and God is just. In other words, you have a choice to do these pillars of the religion or not. God sees it and will reward you. Mm-hmm. That's over and over in the Quran. How does he get around that?
Well, I mean, once again, it's the what level of discourse are you talking about? I mean, you know, it's like the Judean punch thing, you know? And, yeah, when you're looking at it in a macroscopic sort of way, yeah, my following the six pillars of Islam results in my salvation, right? But, of course, you go down to the lower level, down to the microscopic level, and really God's in control of the whole thing. So I think you'd have to deal with it in a similar way. Same way you deal with it with Augustine, right? In any deterministic system, when you speak in ordinary language about as though there were free will and reward and punishment and all that sort of thing, you know, based on what somebody freely did, you've got to make a distinction then between levels of discourse. You got to. So something like that would have to be the reply, I think. You know, it's interesting that Origen, he makes a very different argument in the first principles. Origen, you know, says that, well, why do we have free will? Because God commands us to do X, Y, and Z, and that wouldn't make any sense if we didn't have free will. Which, you know, that argument does make sense. but Al-Ghazali would say, well, then that is compromising God's absolute sovereignty over the universe. And if you start with that, then you have to deny, ultimately, that we do have free will. And so, therefore, and then that's where he draws that distinction between God's will and God's commands. That's really, really important. If there's nothing else you remember, that you should remember that God's will is one thing, and that's whatever God does, and that's whatever happens, because it's all controlled by God, versus God's commands, which don't necessarily align with God's will, because God could command you to do something you can't do. And that's okay. You know? Yeah. But, Marty, I know you're a great admirer of Origen and have a lot more. And I will say that Origen's argument there certainly strikes us as being sensible. Why would I give you a command if I didn't think you could go either way on it? But of course, then that does compromise God's complete control of everything. So, which side are you going to come down on? You know, it's what I've said all along. You know, we have these predicates that we like to ascribe to God, and if you start looking at the details, if you start really getting into it and looking at the details, they're not necessarily consistent with one another. So then which one are you going to gravitate toward? And, of course, we Methodists, I mean, we love to gravitate toward God's benevolence, right? And everything else will have somehow explain away. Well, Al-Ghazali is gravitating in a different direction. He's gravitating toward God's omnipotence and then has to also explain away everything, you know, everything else. So it just depends on which one you think is the most central. Yeah. Well, anyway, he goes on. This is the eighth fundamental I'm going to read. And that one is, I've labeled it voluntarism. What is voluntarism? Well, it's the idea that not only what happens, but also ethical obligations. The whole business is a result of God's voluntas, God's will. Voluntas is just the Latin noun for will. And so voluntarism, then, is the idea that all this is simply a function of God's will. In the Euthyphro, Plato raised the question, or had Socrates raise the question, does God will what is good because it's good, or is what's good good because God wills it? right? I mean, you know, which is more fundamental is the question. Does God will what is good because it's good? In that case, the good would be the more fundamental one. Or is the good good because God wills it? In that case, it would be God's will that is more fundamental, right? Well, if you're a voluntarist, then the answer is the latter, right? The good is good because God wills it. Al-Ghazali, in The Vindication, I forget the rest of the title, but it was the other thing, work of his that I didn't do it this year, but I did it for a previous class, makes the astonishing claim, and it's one I've always remembered just because it's so shocking, that if God had willed lying to be good, then lying would be good because of the voluntaristic stance, because what is good because God wills it. And it's an arbitrary thing. Just so happens that God willed truth-telling to be good. But God didn't will it to be good because it's good. It's good because God willed it to be good. And if God had willed lying to be good, then that would be good. Okay. So, ultimately, you know, this, and this goes back to what I said in response to Reuben's question. Any question beginning with the word why, when asked about God, is simply illicit, because ultimately the buck stops with God's will. That's what voluntarism is. The buck stops with God's will. Muslims to this day, I always get the impression that Muslims to this day are very much in Al-Ghazali's camp, you know? Or, you know, these things happened, it was God's will. I don't have to ask why, it just it's God's will. Well, anyway, the eighth fundamental is that the knowledge of God and obedience to him is a duty imposed upon man by God's command and law, and not, as the Mu'tazilites maintain, by human reason. You know, God does not have to answer to human reason. We have these ideas about, you know, what would be just and all that sort of thing, what would be fair, blah, 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 yeah, 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 yeah. That all applies to President Biden on down and all human beings. Yes, that makes perfectly good sense with respect to human beings. But God is not a human being. God is not part of creation. God is the creator of creation. God is something completely different from anything that we can conceptualize. Why do you think you have to ask why with respect to what God does? Why does God have to answer to rational categories that we apply to one another? That's the question he's asking. Okay.
Don.
Yes.
Don.
Yeah.
But then why would God give us reason to ask those questions if he didn't want us to actually use that reason and ask those questions?
Well, because God's will does not align with God's commands.
Bonnie, you silly girl, you started with why.
Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah.
I got to plug in my computer.
Don, a minor point. You said that was eight. What was seven?
Oh, I haven't been reading every single one of them.
Oh,
I've been
never mind.
Just doing the ones that I thought were the most interesting. Yeah, seven was that he that God does what he wills with his servants and is not incumbent upon him to do what is most favorable for them. But this is a real short one. This is only this part is basically just stating that fundamental again. Doesn't give any arguments.
Right. It sounds like a restatement.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. These are all very closely related, obviously. You know. Well, anyway, then the argument he gives here is kind of, I don't know if it's the translation or if it's not up to his usual standard of clarity, but I'll read it anyway. If the scrutiny and knowledge, here somebody might say this. If the scrutiny and knowledge of the faith are obligatory only through the law, and the law cannot be understood by one to belief without scrutiny, If the scrutiny and knowledge of the faith are obligatory only through the law, and the law cannot be understood by the one called to belief without scrutiny, such a one might answer the prophet who calls him to belief, Reason does not dictate scrutiny to me, and I cannot comprehend with the law without scrutiny, but I do not wish to undertake scrutiny unless it has been made obligatory. That will lead to silencing the prophet. Okay, let me try to cut to the chase here. This person is saying that, or is in a situation where one cannot, this reminds me a little bit of William James, oddly enough, that one cannot believe something without understanding it, but one will not try to understand it unless one believes it. So you're in this sort of catch-22 situation. You know, and he's, once again, he has the metazoites in mind here. Remember, the metazoites are the rationalists. I mean, that was another, that's another characteristic of them. They insisted that it's got to make sense. But they would not be, but if somebody's really a metazoite, suppose indeed you're confronted with a theological doctrine that you're not going to believe unless you understand it, but then you're not going to be motivated to understanding it unless you think it's true and worth the trouble of trying to understand. You see, so you're sort of in a, and suppose this is a doctrine that is the deciding point between salvation and damnation. You know, if you take that kind of attitude, that I'm not going to try to understand it unless I'm sure that it's true, but I can't be assured that it's true unless I, as it turns out, unless I understand it, then you're never going to be saved. You're letting your reason interfere with your salvation. So he gives an analogy. The analogy actually is clearer than what I just read. We would say in reply that this supposition resembles the following dialogue. One person says to another standing in a certain place, "There is surely behind you a carnivorous lion. If you do not believe your place, if you do not leave your place, he will kill you. And if you look back, you will see my truthfulness." The one standing retorts, "Your truthfulness will not be established unless I look back. And I do not look back to see unless your truthfulness is proven." This retort indicates the foolishness of the one who made it and his exposure to destruction. So the analogy there is you're not going to look back unless you're convinced that the person telling you is saying something that's true. But then again, you're not going to validate that it's true unless you do look back. So next thing you know, you're eaten by the lion, right? Same thing here. The belief in the doctrine is not going to happen. It's not going to happen unless it's understood. But you're not going to be motivated to understand it unless you believe in the first place. So the whole point is, I mean, what's really important about this particular one is it really is an attack on rationalism in religion. I mean, and remember, as I say, the metazoites were the rationalists, you know. And so, I mean, that was, in addition to me, the people of unity and justice, you might also say unity, justice, and reason, because everything they insisted had to make sense. And Al-Ghazali is simply saying, well, no, there's some things that are not going to make sense. Or maybe, in a William James kind of fashion, if you at least admit that they, if you start with the presumption that they make, that it makes sense, you'll somehow come to that understanding. But if you don't, if you start as a skeptic, you'll never get there. Something along those lines. Well, anyway, clearly though, the voluntarism of Al-Ghazali's Asharite theology is inconsistent with a purely rationalist understanding, right? Because what God does frequently does not make sense. And that's okay, because God is God, and God is not a human. God's not the President of the United States or whatever. God is a completely different being. Why should it? Why do we assume that it has to make sense? That's the position anyway. So, I was going to say something else, but I don't remember what it was. So I don't know if you like that or not, but that, there it is. The only other one I wanted to talk about, I wanted to spend a few minutes at the end of class talking about what I would like to do next year, if we do continue. The very last one under three is the ninth bundle, this is not quite the heady theology that we've been talking about here. The tenth fundamental, this is under the third pillar, is that God Most High sent Muhammad, God bless and save him, as the seal of the prophets and as the abrogator of the religious laws. That's important, the abrogator of the religious laws of the Jews, Christians, and Sabians. I should read you, I didn't bring it down and I don't have time now, but the Sabians, you say, who are the Sabians? Well, it turns out there was this group, I think in Iraq, and the caliph, I think, went through town and said, are you a people of the book? And then somebody had told them ahead of time, you got to be a people of the book. Otherwise, you're going to get exterminated. You know, but you'll be tolerated if you're a people of the book. So they say, yeah, we are. And so the caliph, or whoever it was, went on and said, I'm going to be back. But when I come back, you have to show me what book you're a people of. So he went on. Then he came back. Well, in the meantime, they got together and they decided that they would settle on the Hermetica, you know, the writings of Hermes Trismegistus, which was a collection of, oh, I don't know, sort of like, kind of like the Old Testament Apocrypha, even, that was circulating in the late Roman period, as well as all scads of other religious texts, all this stuff going around. And so, yeah, so he came back through and he said, okay, produce the book. So here, the writings of Hermes Trismegistus, that we call the Hermetica now. And so that was okay. So they passed the test. Those are the Sabians. So these are three peoples of the book, Jews, Christians, and Sabians, that existed before him and confirmed him with, we're continuing the sentence, confirmed Muhammad with, God did, with clear miracles and dazzling signs, and such as, and these must be mostly Hadith, the splitting of the moon, the praise of God by the pebbles, the causing of mute animals to speak, the gushing of water from between his fingers, and the clear sign of the great Quran, with which he challenged all the Arabs. The only one of these that's not sort of a tradition is the great Quran. For they defamed the prophet, asked him to desist, and even attempted to kill him. But despite their distinction in eloquence and rhetoric, they failed to confront him with anything like the Quran. The reason is that it is beyond human capacity to imitate its purity of language and style, let alone what it contains of reports about ancient peoples proclaimed by a prophet who was illiterate and did not read books, and what it contains of forecasts of the unknown, which future events proved true. So the Quran is like nothing else. Of course, I don't read Arabic, but I have read of those who do, whose first language is Arabic, that the Quran strikes them maybe like Chaucer or Shakespeare or something, strikes our ear, or the King James Bible strikes our ear. There's something about, I guess, maybe older forms of speech, maybe, that to us sound more poetic. I'm not sure what it is exactly. I remember, though, I first, when my older daughter Laura was, oh, I don't know, about 8 or 9, I sat down with the Canterbury Tales and read the prologue, at least trying to pronounce the words in the way they would have been pronounced, which is really phonetically. That's why we have the crazy spelling, because our spelling reflects Middle English, and we don't speak Middle English anymore. But anyway, I read it that way. And she goes, oh, that's the most beautiful thing I've ever heard, was her reaction. And I think that's the same idea with the Quran. To an Arabic speaker, it has this kind of beauty to it, this unearthly beauty. How could a human have ever produced that? No, the Quran existed forever in heaven. It's God's eternal speech that was delivered to Muhammad in time, truly, but the speech itself has always been there. In fact, the speech itself is outside time, because God is outside time. And the beauty of it indicates that it has a more than human origin. See? So That's a nice, I know that kind of comes around full circle, hasn't it? You know, we're back to where we started with the reason for the Quran in the first place. So there you go. That is the pretty thorough review, I guess you'd say, of the Asharite interpretation of the Quran. And it's nice to contrast it with the Mu'tazilite. And as I say, the nice thing about looking at another religion is it gives you insights into your own. So that's the end of, I mentioned last week, this is our 40th year. My first year was 1981 when I started teaching this class. So let me say something about what I've been working on, or stuff I have in my head. Well, before I do this, does anybody have any other questions about what we've been talking about or comments before I change the subject? Okay.
Don, it sounds like for Al-Ghazali that the problem of evil is not really a problem.
Yeah.
Because the sort of the predicates behind the problem of evil that God is, you know, loving and caring and just really aren't.
Exactly.
Not applicable.
Yeah, exactly. They're category mistakes, as I said. God is all powerful. It's all you need. Yeah. It would be like, it's the opposite. Remember Tom Ord? Remember he was in our class once and he had that book, God Can't, remember? It's exactly the opposite, right? So he wants to give up God's omnipotence and go with God's benevolence. Al-Ghazali is the opposite, yeah.
I'm almost surprised he didn't turn into an atheist, Don.
Me?
No, the guy you were, that rickety framework he was describing didn't hold together.
You know? Who, Al-Ghazali, you mean?
Yeah.
Oh, why would he be an atheist? I mean, he's more consistent than we are. All you have to do is take one of those predicates and run with it and work out the complete logic, and you got something that's much more watertight than holding incompatible ideas.
I understand, but it ends up with an unappealing answer.
Oh, well, unappealing, but, you know, that's just an emotional reaction.
He could decide, you know, I don't need a God for this to be this way.
Yeah, but then you better watch out because you know what's going to happen.
I'm brother number two.
Yeah, right, exactly.
It's going to happen regardless of what you think.
Yeah, that's right. I'll see you in hell, Pat, I guess.
Yeah. Or heaven.
Well, it's sort of the opposite. Whether there's hymns where we all meet in heaven. Anyway. other ideas for, or other things I've been thinking about. I spent a lot of time last summer working on William James, and so I think you'd enjoy that. He's another one of those 19th century figures, but anyway, he wrote a number of works on religion. He's a pragmatist, you know. Peirce, James, and Dewey. I don't know why everything has to come in threes. I don't know what it is. But anyway, Peirce, James, and Dewey are sort of the classical pragmatists. And so James is the most readable of the three by far. And anyway, and he spent a fair amount of his professional career in the area of philosophy of religion. You know, the will to believe, of course, is famous, and then the word pragmatism and pluralistic universe is another one. There are about, I don't know, half a dozen or so of his, the variety of religious experience, another one. I would like to do something on William James. Another thing that's kind of hanging fire, you'll remember some of you, gee, this is maybe 2 or 3 years ago now. It doesn't seem possible, but there it is. We went over Jay, the Yahwist, remember? And what was his name? Friedman? Richard Friedman? Is that right?
Richard Elliott Friedman.
Yeah, okay, Richard Friedman. He's the one that put together that version of the Pentateuch that's color-coded that I have, that's really kind of really useful, really, really useful. But he also then put together, well, he's the one that years ago wrote that book called Who Wrote the Bible. It's a very competent presentation of the documentary hypothesis. But then he put together that book called The Hidden Book in the Bible, which is his take on what J is, which goes, he thinks, all the way up through the beginning of 1 Kings. Well, I never did E. E is far, far, far shorter or more fragmentary than J. E is the northern version. J is the southern version of 10th century, so scholars think, 10th century version, or it was circulated in the 10th century, around the time of Solomon. So that, I never did it, so I thought that would be a good thing to do. Another thing that I have in mind is I have, there's some early documents, Porphyry, Celsus, and I think, it may be Julian the Apostate, opponents of Christianity. It would be interesting to see what they had to say, and that's kind of out there. I've thought about doing that. And, oh shoot, there's one other thing I had in mind. Oh my gosh. Well, whatever it was interesting. But I don't remember what it was. But, you know, anyway, those are the kind of things that I have in mind for the future. Darn it. We got 3 minutes. Does anybody have anything else? Maybe I'll send everybody an email when I think of that last thing. I had it in mind when I was thinking about this yesterday.
I remember you saying once you were going to do a series on the Iliad.
That's right. That was not actually what I was thinking about, but you're right. I did say that as a pacifist work. Right? Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't remember what that other thing was. Darn it. Anyway, it was. Yeah. I just have all these ideas. Anyway, so we got to quit. We only have 2 minutes. So, see ya.
Thanks for a very informative semester.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Yes, thank you, Don.
Uh-huh.
Good summer, everyone.
Yeah.
Thank you. Have a great summer and a good trip.
Yeah. Thanks. What was that other thing?